I want to welcome everyone to the series this year, the 2,000 Years of the Jewish Odyssey. This is part one, the first century of the Common Era. As in the past years, I want to thank Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring the series this year. Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib, Tei Nishmaso Tzur B'Tzur Chaim. Welcome my in-laws to shul tonight. So, this is intended as a review of the fundamental events and personalities and trends that shape Jewish life until today. We are an historic people. The Torah tells us in the Shiras HaZinu, Zechor Yemos Olam, Binu Shnos Dor Vador. Remember the days of old, and Binu, understand the years of every generation. And that really is our quest. In our history, we see the Yad Hashem, God's hand. Otherwise, it would be impossible for our lamb to have survived among the 70 wolves for so long. So we're a historic people, but we're also a people with a history, with a bond and an affinity, and even a very close relationship with millennia preceding us in a way that other nations, other peoples just cannot claim. What we are today is substantially because of who preceded us, the people and their accomplishments, the events that shaped them, the Piskei Halacha, the halachic decisions that articulated the Torah's responses to new situations in every generation, the leaders that we had who made good decisions, sometimes awful decisions, mistakes that we made and often repeat today as well, trends in Jewish life that endure and define us over time. So that is our study. Now, of course, the Common Era is a Christian temporal frame. It has nothing to do with Jews going back 2,000 years. We start with the year one, which is 2,007 years ago, only because it makes for ease of reference in understanding events and trends in the non-Jewish world. So my preference, of course, would be to use our dates from creation on. But if I said to you, let's start in the 39th century, for most of us it wouldn't mean anything to us. So therefore we use the secular dates. Keep in mind that the Christian calendar was not finalized until the 4th century, so the early dates have no real Christian significance in that sense either. We'll get back to this a little later, but Jesus, for example, was born in the year 4, before the Common Era, not as you would have assumed in the year 1, and certainly there's no year 0. So we begin in the year 3861, as we count to creation, which is 2,007 years ago, as right now, or 8 years ago, right now in the year 5769, since the creation of Adam HaRishon. And again, I use just the block of 2,000 years because as we commonly use that number in our daily lives, it makes for an era of history that is more or less self-contained, that by and large, at least for the last millennium, not for the one before that, we can relate to very easily, as opposed to going back into ancient times, where of course the documentation is much more scarce, even a little tenuous. Alright, so we start in the year 3861, in the year 1, but actually we have to start before, with Herod. Herod died in the year 4, before the Common Era, BCE, but his specter looms large over events in the first century of the Common Era, which is our focus. So Herod began his rule in the year 37 before the Common Era, succeeding his father Antipater. Now his father was an Idumean. The Idumeans were a people that dwelled in southern Judea as well as in Transjordan, who were forcibly converted by the Hashmonaim. So the Jewish status was always somewhat in doubt. That's always a danger. We see the same thing happen. We'll get back to it in a lecture or two with the Kutim. The Kutim were people brought from Crete, settled in Israel by Nebuchadnezzar 4 or 5 centuries before, forcibly converted. Chazal say they were Gerei Arroyos. They converted out of fear of lions, Arroyos with an olive. And over time, it took 8 centuries to clarify their status, and Chazal finally determined that they were not really Jews, and so by the 3rd or 4th century, they were written out of the Jewish people. we have almost a similar problem today with non-Jewish Russians in Israel. Maybe 300,000-400,000 who don't really want to be part of the Jewish nation as much as they like living in Israel. Since we are a religio nation, not just a religion but a nation as well, it's not just a question of citizenship but also of nationality and faith. And that can't be forced on people. The Idumeans were forced, and as often happens with the Kutim as well, and who knows with the Russians too, in our day the consequences were dire. So Antipater was an aide of Hyrcanus, one of the last of the Hashmonoi rulers. The Hashmonoi civil war had left Rome in control of Israel. Pompey became the ruler as the emperor. The warring factions of the Hashmonoim appealed to Rome to settle their dispute, and Rome did by taking over the whole country. Antipater schemed and maneuvered until he had supplanted Hyrcanus as the power, all this with the approval of Julius Caesar. Now, Antipater was a cruel tyrant. His only saving grace was relative. His son Herod was far worse, a malicious, spiteful, vengeful, sadistic dictator. So he took power, Herod did, after another 3-year civil war with Antigonus, the head of the Hashmonaim. In the process, Herod slaughtered thousands of Jews. His first order of business in 37 before the Common Era was to execute 46 members of the Sanhedrin. The most famous survivor, the one he spared because of his popularity, was Shammai HaZaken, the great Shammai whom we'll return to. He then murdered the royal house of the Hashmonaim, leaving alive only Miriam, the granddaughter of the previous king. He married Miriam, but later murdered her as well, along with many of his own sons. Eventually, the surviving princess of the house of the Hashmonaim, a young woman, committed suicide. So the Gemara says in Baba Basra, Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, anyone who claims he's of Hashmonoi descent, avdahu, he's actually a slave and not a Hashmonoi. Now, there are two immediate consequences and long-range consequences to Herod's reign. When he executed the members of the Sanhedrin en masse, of course, they had to go underground, and this precipitated the decline of the Sanhedrin as their influence waned and their ability to teach Torah very rapidly diminished. This gave rise to something we're all familiar with today, the machlokes, the halachic dispute. First several, then by the hundreds. By our day, it's in the thousands, if not the tens of thousands. And it happened because the Torah could no longer be fully explicated. An issue used to arise, the Sanhedrin would resolve it immediately, or in a short amount of time. Now, the Sanhedrin was in hiding, and they were afraid to assert themselves, so different traditions arose which could not be harmonized. The second consequence was that Herod insisted, not for the first time in Jewish history, but for the first time and probably the last time until our day, on a separation of religion and state. And he turned the remnant of the Sanhedrin and the Kahuna, which was compromised anyway by corruption, into religious functionaries. That is to say, in charge of ritual, halachic details, but not at all policy and not at all governance. Part of the interesting ambiance in Israel the last 60 years has been that tension between the role of religious Jews, especially Rabbanim. Should it be limited to ritual, kashrus, and the Chevra Kadisha, or should they be involved in policy and governance as well? Well, Herod spoke for his time, let the Rabbanim remain in the yeshiva and the shuls and stay out of public life. That notion is alive and well today in part of Israel also. Now, Herod fares much better in secular history because of his strong alliance with Rome and his willingness to do their dirty work. He actually stabilized the land of Israel. So Herod's Israel was very prosperous. It was at peace internally and externally as well. He kept the internal peace with a heavy hand, and externally he was an ally of Rome. He was a supporter of the emperors. He made Israel a center, a world center of trade, and he himself became extremely wealthy. And Herod is well known, renowned as a patron of civic life across the Roman Empire, not just in the land of Israel. He built temples and theaters and forums from Rhodes to Beirut, from Damascus to Tripoli, even in Athens and Sparta, all on his shekel. Also, he greased the palms of many Roman emperors and many Roman senators as well. So he was a popular figure in Rome. Of course, the main physical legacy in Israel today is Herodion. Those are the sites that people visit until today, especially Caesarea, which was a new city with a port that he himself built. The Maras HaMachpelah in Hebron was built by Herod, the Herodion near Tekoa, the fortress in Sebastia, Matsada. Eretz Yisrael is dotted with palaces and fortresses of Herod that were so well built, many of them endure until today. And one other thing, the Gemara says in Baba Basra, Daf Gimel Beis, the story continues on Dalet Amud Aleph, among the Chachamim he left alive was an aged sage, blind, named Bava ben Buta. And Herod, the Gemara tells a story, once visited Bava ben Buta in disguise. Hard to know why he had to disguise himself, he was blind, but he tried to induce Bava ben Buta to curse him, to curse the king, so he'd have an excuse to kill him, saying, look what this Avda Bisha, look what this lowly slave Herod, meaning himself, has done. And Bava ben Buta refused to take the bait, quoting the Pasuk in Koheles that in English has come down to us as even the walls have ears. The bird will carry this, whatever I say, outside these walls. He refused. So Herod said, how could he redeem, eventually Bava realized who he was, and Herod said, how could he redeem himself in the eyes of the people? So Bava said to him, you blinded Eino Shel Olam, the eye of the world, meaning the Beis HaMikdash, so now be an Oseg Be'eino Shel Olam. And Herod undertook the elaborate reconstruction of the Beis HaMikdash, to the point that Chazal say there in the Gemara, Mishal Rab Binyan Hurdus, or Rab Binyan Noah Miyamov. Anyone who did not see the building, the edifice of Hurdus, has never seen a beautiful building in his life. The Beis HaMikdash had white and yellow and blue marble, with Chazal exclaiming, and their eyewitnesses, that it looked like Idvata Diyama from a distance. The blue marble looked like the blue waves of the sea. It looked like it was in motion. Such an attractive site became a tourist attraction. People came from across the world to see the Beis HaMikdash. He expanded it to almost twice the size, and of course its western retaining wall, the Kotel, remains until today. It was a masterful feat of construction. Hard to figure out how they did it. Stones weighing tons, some of them weighing a dozen or more tons, but not hewn with iron, as the Torah prohibits that. Herod was also very careful to ordain, to maintain the avodah, the service in the Beis HaMikdash, even during construction, because the mizbech remained the same. They continued bringing karbanos every day. The construction took 40-50 years. It was dedicated in his lifetime, but it continued well after his death. Herod being Herod, when the Mikdash was rededicated a short time before his death, he placed the Roman eagle on the front gate. Some of the young Talmidei Chachamim tore it down. The Chachamim protested, and Herod killed them and others, brought them all to his palace in Jericho. Part of it still stands as well, and burn them alive. So Herod is a key figure as we move into the first century, even though he died 4 years before the Common Era. With his death, stable, so to speak, Jewish reign ended in Israel. Now the son of his first wife, Herod had a number of non-Jewish wives also, the son of his first wife, his name is Archelaus, succeeded him, and he was as paranoid as his father, I guess without the personality or the connections. He killed people wantonly, just to show that he was the boss, the first regel, that he was the king, Pesach. He just ordered soldiers to kill Jews who were making Aliyah LeRegel, kill them by the thousands. And Shavuos was the same thing, and this became a regular pattern just to assert his control. A delegation of Roman Jews and Jews from Israel eventually went to Rome to plead with them that they would prefer direct Roman rule than having Archelaus. And eventually it worked. In the year 6, he was deposed, exiled to Gaul, and thereafter, for the most part, the land of Israel was ruled by Roman governors called procurators. Now, during Herod's time, one of the great figures in Jewish history came to live in Israel. Keep in mind that towards the beginning of the first century, the common era, a Roman census, and they were meticulous in these matters, revealed that Jews numbered 8 million people, roughly 10% of the Roman Empire. We are not that much larger today, maybe 11, 12 million people, depending on how you number Jews. Of the 8 million people, only 2.5 million lived in Eretz Yisrael. So you had 5.5 million Jews living outside the land of Israel, including one of the largest cities was Alexandria, which had over 1 million Jews. Most Jews lived in exile, and the Torah center was Bavel. So it was no surprise that a Babylonian came several decades before the Common Era and became the Nasi, one of the most influential figures in Jewish history, and that, of course, is Hillel HaZaken, Hillel the Elder. So the Gemara in Pesachim, Daf Samech Vav Amid Aleph, relates the story of his selection. I told it a few years ago on Shabbos HaGadol. Only he had come right before Pesach as an 80-year-old, making Aliyah for the second time from Bavel. Only he was able to teach, to answer the question of whether Korban Pesach is Doche Shabbos when Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos. I mean, Erev Pesach came out on Shabbos. They didn't remember whether or how the Korban Pesach is brought. Only he knew. Now that fact alone underscores, and they right away elevated him to be the Nasi. The rulers at the time, the Bnei Beser, went to the background. That fact alone underscores the relative level of scholarship, even then, in Bavel versus the land of Israel. That means that the Torah centers of Jewish life have been outside Israel for most of 25 centuries, going back to the first Churban, except for relatively brief periods, and that's undeniable. That's why it's such a historic shift. It may be changing today because of the growth in the population of Israel and the proliferation of Torah. So now the Torah center, for the first time since the Churban, might be shifting towards Israel as opposed to someplace in the exile. Bavel also, as the Gemara Kiddusha notes towards the end, had much more rigorous standards of Yichus than they did in Eretz Yisrael in determining not only who was Jewish, but who was a Meyuchas, whose genealogy could be traced and was pure with any taint of Mamzerus or any other problem. He'll return to Israel. He comes once to learn, like many people do when he was younger. He returned for the second time at age 80. And again, to make the point of where Jewish life was, Sigmar says in Sukkot Daf Chof Amud Aleph, Shebitchilo kishenishtakcha Torah miYisrael, at first when the Torah was forgotten in Israel, Olo Ezra miBavel viYosado, Ezra came after the first Churban, during the beginning of the second temple era, and he restored Torah again in the land of Israel. Chazar ben Ishtakcha, again it was forgotten by the Jews. Ola Hillel Habavli the Yisada. Hillel came and restored it. And about two centuries later, same thing happened again. Ola Reb Chiya Ubanov the Yisadua. So it was very hard to sustain Torah in the land of Israel because of all the physical, political pressures the people were under. They're constantly being replenished by Rabbonim and Talmidei Chachamim coming from Bavel. Hillel was a bright spot during the darkness of Herod's reign. He was a religious leader of the people. It came about the year 30 before the Common Era, and he was the religious leader until the year 10 of the Common Era when he died. But he founded what became known as Beis Hillel, the House of Hillel, which would not only be a dominant spiritual force, but for the most part, the family of the Nasiim. For the next couple of centuries, Hillel's family were Zera David, descendants of David HaMelech, and therefore they were natural for rulers. Keep in mind, Shammai was there as well. Shammai was very well respected. Beis Shammai preceded Beis Hillel chronologically. That's why many say Beis Shammai's opinion is always quoted first in the Mishnah, as if that was the teaching, and then Beis Hillel came along and added their opinion to Beis Shammai's opinion. In due course, Beis Hillel was more numerous, and the Mishnah was edited by Hillel's descendants. Halacha follows Beis Hillel, but that's only because of events in Yavne, which we'll get back to, took place after the Churban. So separate schools arose, so to speak, because Shammai's school existed as a pure Torah institution that was tolerated by Herod. He did not allow, it used to be that law, legislation, takanos were made by the Sanhedrin, with the Sanhedrin underground or under wraps because of Herod. So a Beis Shammai arose, the yeshiva where they would sit and learn and discuss issues and try to promulgate whatever was necessary for religious life, as well as to maintain the standards of Torah in a very hostile environment. Herod would not have allowed the school of the Nazi to join together. So again, the separate schools also made for an increase in disputes and a lack of uniformity. So questions that were previously resolved now went unresolved, as it was especially in light of the weakening of the Sanhedrin, including executions under Antipater and then under Herod. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Pechesem Beis Misharabu Tamidei Shammai VeHillel. Shiloshim Shu Kol Sarkon, when the students of Shammai and Hillel increased in number, and they were not able to serve their masters Kol Sarkon as much as they needed. Rabu Machlokas Bi Yisrael V'Naseis Torah K'Shtei Toros. Disputes proliferated in Israel, and the Torah became two Toros. In a sense, the Torah became more developed, and all the possibilities within the framework of halacha were explored. That's a positive. It has a very obvious downside in that resolutions became more difficult to impose, uniformity became impossible to impose, and that really exists until today as well. So it was a philosophical problem, these machlokos, but a methodological strength that enabled the Jewish people to carry the Torah with us for centuries into the most inhospitable environments and live it. Now, we shouldn't exaggerate. Keep in mind that Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel agreed on most things. There are only a few hundred details, particulars of halacha on which they disagreed. There are thousands and tens of thousands of areas in which they uniformity. You find, if you go through Shas, you see there are particular details of halachos, like how do you light Hanukkah candles, 1 to 8 or 8 to 1, like that. But no one argued whether there's a mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, or what an esrog looked like, or whether tefillin were square and black, etc. The basics were agreed upon. The details found themselves in arguments. And keep in mind as well another important point, it's always good to mention this, that notwithstanding the seriousness of the disputes between them, Gemara says in Yevamah Daf Yud Dalet Amud Beis, Shechiba v'Reis Nohagim Zebazeh, on a personal level, they were all friendly and very warm to each other. They even intermarried with each other, even though they had different ideas about different psulei kiddushin. L'kayim ha'shenemar, to fulfill the pasuk, ho'emes v'shalom ehavu. You could love both peace and truth. They're not antagonists. They can go together. One can disagree and not be disagreeable. And the model, the prototype of that is Hill and Shammai. The Mishnah says in Avos, they are the symbol of Machlokas L'Shem Shamayim. It's not personal, it's just ideas and issues, which is always the way of Torah. Now the Nisius itself was a relatively new institution. It had been created as a counterweight to the corrupt Kohanim Gedolim in the second Beis HaMikdash era. Think back to Shimon HaTzadik in the beginnings of the second Beis HaMikdash. So he was a Kohen Gadol. But especially during and after the time of the Chashmonaim, the position of the Kohanim Gedolah was very often sold and unworthy people took it. So the Kohen Gadol had been the natural spiritual leader that was lost. And because of the low level of the Kohanim Gedolim, that the Sanhedrin created this institution of Nasi. We had Zugos for several centuries, one person a Nasi, the other the Abbasin, all elected by the Sanhedrin based on their Torah greatness, with the nullification of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. and the persecution of the sages, so Torah leadership became more scattered, could no longer risk election, and thus the Nesius after Hillel became a hereditary position. It was Hillel's descendants for a couple of centuries that were the Nesium. Hillel, of course, as we know, was renowned for sterling character, is very humble, self-effacing, very tolerant. Gemara has a number of stories in this regard. He served as the Nasi for 40 years until the year 10. He died at the age of 120. He was very much in tune with the people, very popular. He had many, many takanos. I don't want to say innovations in halacha, but certainly explications of different halachic areas. One famous one we just lived through, of course, Hillel's Prusbul, to mitigate the effects on the wealthy not lending money before the Shemitah year. So the Prusbul transformed a private debt into a debt which would be collected by the Beis Din, and therefore commerce credit would be able to be extended even in the Shemitah year or shortly before. I think most people encounter Hillel though only at the Seder as the founder of the first sandwich. He is our Earl of Sandwich. Korech. Zecher le Mikdash Kehillel. That's only because of Machlokes, whether he had to have the Karm Pesach and Mas and Mar all together. Now, something else was inaugurated in Jewish life because of the schools of Hillel and Shammai, and that was the ear of the Tanoim. On a technical basis, Tanoim start with Shimon HaTzadik, but on a practical basis, the ear of the Tanoim started. Now, Tanoim means those who repeat the study. That is to say, these two schools clarified most of the halachos, they eliminated all other opinions, they narrowed down the issues as well as what they're arguing about. Their opinions were collected very often in writing, and the Talmid Chacham would study them and analyze them, and these were the Tanoim whose work was later recorded in the Mishnah, the end of the next century. It was mostly an oral compendium, and therefore, as we know, it's subject to minor distinctions in phraseology, and you find very often the Gemara will argue at length to ascertain what the true Masorah was. And you find also at different times the same idea would be brought down in slightly divergent language only because it was an oral tradition. What Hillel and Shammai did was spark a wave of Talmud Torah in their lives because of Herod's very heavy hand and that of his son, so people were not as engaged in public or civic life as they had been before, so they had thousands and thousands of disciples, and therefore Talmud Torah itself had a renaissance. The majority of the people were followers of Hillel and Shammai, Perushim, the Tzedukim, who became very famous and very influential as both leftists and supporters of Rome and deniers of the Torah Shebaal Peh. They were a minority of people, but in fact they controlled the media, and they were the elites of the society, so their influence seems greater than it was. Also shades of Jewish life today. Now the deaths of Herod and Archelaus unleashed the Jewish national spirit. So the leaders, even the Persian, preferred Roman rule to Archelaus, but many preferred Jewish rule. So already in the year 6 of the Common Era, Yehuda of Gamla rebelled. The Galil was always a hotbed of revolt, and a defeat in battle never seemed to deter the next guy from thinking he's going to defeat the mighty Roman Empire. Most of the Roman Empire was docile. Judea was almost never docile. Why was that? So what was wrong with the political stability that was engendered by Herod and Rome? See, Rome at that time was not even interfering with the practice of halacha or the study of Torah. They just wanted taxes and live your own life. The historian Paul Johnson surmises, and I think it's a very astute observation, that the Jews were not, unlike other peoples subjugated by Rome, we were not warlike or tribal or backward, but exactly the opposite. Jews always rebelled against Roman rule, any foreign rule, because he says we were too advanced, we were too educated, too literate, too intellectually conscious to be ruled by a people that we consider to be pagans and inferior to us. Our culture, our ideas, our values were much older than the Greeks, than Greek culture, and Jews were defined by a rejection of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry. So therefore it was anathema to the Jewish people to be subject to the rule of a nation that we considered our moral inferiors, pagans, Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and therefore it never sit well with us. Around the same time, already in the first century of the Common Era, a group called the Zealots became active under Yehuda of the Galil. Another group, the Sicarii, also rose, and they would orchestrate violent attacks against Romans, guerrilla warfare, and Jews as well, who disagreed with them, until the Churban. By the year 30, Judea was a tumultuous place to live, with warring groups and sects. The heavy hand of Rome under a particularly cruel procurator named Pontius Pilate. There was disunity amongst the people. Around the year 30, things were so bad that the Sanhedrin stopped hearing capital cases. They left, they exiled themselves from the Lishkas HaGozes in the Beis HaMikdash, Marseh and Shabbos, Daf Tesvav, Amad Aleph. They stopped using the Egla Rufa, which was an act of expiation for an unresolved homicide, because there were just too many homicides to deal with. That's how much Jewish life had deteriorated. All this turmoil and political uncertainty made Israel ripe for saviors and salvation, and into that milieu stepped Christianity. As I mentioned, Jesus was born around the year 4 before the Common Era. He died at some point, I guess that's arguable for our neighbors, but he died in the year 29 or 32, 35. It's not really known precisely because his life was not recorded in contemporaneously. Rather, all the accounts of Christianity arose well after his lifetime. Now, it would be an exaggeration to state that he was well known while he lived. He wasn't well known. He wasn't even the only person claiming to be the Messiah around the time. The Talmud barely refers to him. And not all the references in the Talmud to Yeshu are necessarily to Jesus of Nazareth. Some of them are anachronistic, placing this person about 150 years earlier. Some of the details don't mesh very well with Halacha, for example. The claim that the Last Supper was the Seder would mean his execution took place on Pesach, when the Sanhedrin would not have met. Wouldn't even met on Erev Pesach, much less on Pesach itself. The references to Jesus in Josephus' writings that are almost universally held, almost universally even by Christian scholars, to be later interpolations, meaning that centuries later, not maybe even in modern times, scholars imposed on Josephus' works whole paragraphs relating to Jesus that he never wrote, because no indication he even knew of him or heard of him, which clearly reflect a hand which was not his. Keep in mind, the earliest Gospels did not appear for decades after his truth, and the stories in the Gospels conflict in many details. I guess when people speak of the Gospel truth, it can mean several things, not just one. Now, several things are assumed by Chazal. Firstly, he was perceived as a heretic by the Chachamim. Some of his contentions, they have to say, were later embraced by Reform Judaism. That is to say, de-emphasizing mitzvos and emphasizing God's grace. He was also seen as a renegade and as a danger to Rome. So in fact, his execution was a foregone conclusion, because Pilate executed Jews by the thousands, and his ideas were meant to reform Judaism and not at all to create a new religion. That is to say, the new religion and the popularization of the man himself was the work of Saul of Tarsus, Paul, who never met Jesus, but became convinced of his resurrection. Now, he never made many inroads among Jews. He became a preacher, Paul did, to non-Jews, depicting Christianity at first as a Jewish sect and gaining adherence in other lands, because Judaism was known and respected by many non-Jews. But he clearly incorporated some pagan aspects that would appeal to non-Jews, and so later in the century, the Chachamim in Yavne would orchestrate a clean break, adding what became the 19th bracha to the Shemoneh Esrei. Shemoneh Esrei means 18, but it has 19 brachas. That bracha of Olam Al Shinim would try to uncover any secret Christians in their midst. It was in the year 85 of the Common Era. A person who would refuse, a shatz who would refuse to recite this bracha was suspected and was not allowed to assume the amud. Now, bear in mind, of course, that many aspects of Christian theology would not be clarified for centuries. Some still remain to be clarified. Christianity is actually a very fluid religion in that sense. Even they claim that the doctrine is, Mycenae, so to speak. The papal infallibility, for example, is a 19th century doctrine. It was unknown before then. It was instituted by Pius IX after a series of blunders that he'd made. It was unknown for 18 centuries. So it's only 150 years old or so. Paul himself, and there are other doctrines also in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, always adding on. So really, their doctrines are always subject to change depending on the Pope's will. Now, Paul went on a mission, traveling through much of the civilized world, encountering much opposition, but also sowing the seeds of a new movement. And this you find in the New Testament. We visit the Galatians and the Corinthians and the Salonicans, etc. Everyone but the Jews. And this, if you'd ask me, this and not our alleged complicity in his death is what produced the 2,000-year-old hatred of Christianity for Jews. It's because we didn't accept him, not because we killed him. It's as if we say, till today, look, we live there, we knew him, and we still rejected him. So we're the only eyewitnesses to his claims, and we rejected it. So one can argue that for all their claims that we killed their God, what troubles them more is that we gave them their God, and didn't, because he was Jewish, and didn't find anything special about him. You know, one wag once said that Mary was not the first Jewish mother who thought her son was God. The seeds of this tortured, not the last either, the seeds of this tortured relationship were sown in the first century and still colors events today. It was our rejection at that time, which has really been a specter hovering over the Jewish people since then, until today. Paul was executed in Rome in 64 for his preaching. By then he saw himself as the founder of a new religion, but by then also we had other fish to fry, other issues to deal with, the Churban. Along with the influence of Christian, early influence of Christianity, the Churban and our tortured relationship with the Christians, the Churban is the event that still shapes our lives and our worldview, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, no disaster has to happen, but the Churban was a disaster that was waiting to happen. Between the Zealots and the Sicarion and the Prushim, who largely opposed the revolt against Rome as suicidal, and a faction called Friends of Rome, mainly Tzedukim, who were openly pro-Roman, the Second Jewish Commonwealth was not destroyed as much as it self-destructed. It's an interesting story. I remember I was in Israel about 30 years ago in the late 70s on Tisha B'Av, and at night they had a Tisha B'Av program on television. If you think back to the politics of the 70s, they were debating the issue of what faction you would have been a member of had you lived at that time. So Shulamit Aloni was on, and she said she was one of the Friends of Rome. Was pro-Roman, there were leftists, there were Tzedukim, and Geula Kohn said, an old-time revisionist, Irgunist, Likudnik, she said that she would have been the Zealots, because you have to fight for the homeland. And Hanan Porat, and Lichochem in the group, he would have supported Menachem ben Zakkai, because you see who survived, who didn't survive. But that was the discussion that took place. Now, I have to backtrack just a little. In the early decades of the first century, the procurators were all evil and violent, as were most of the Roman emperors. You had legendary figures like Caligula and Gaius, who tried to have statues of themselves placed in the Beis HaMikdash. The first time Caligula tried, he ordered sent a message to the proconsul of Syria, Petronius, to see to it that it's done, and Petronius traveled to Eretz Yisrael, mobilized his armies to enforce this order in Yerushalayim. He was greeted in Tiberia, named after Caligula's predecessor, Tiberius. 10,000 Jews prostrated themselves on the highway before the army of Petronius, saying, "You can kill us, but we're not going to allow you to go to Yerushalayim." And Petronius caved, and he decided not, and it was one of the rare moments of beneficence, he decided not to do it. He relented, defied the emperor. The emperor ordered Petronius to commit suicide, but providentially Caligula died very suddenly. Pontius Pilate became the procurator in 25. He ruled for 10 years. He was not only brutal, but like most of the procurators, rapacious, stealing and looting and demanding exorbitant taxes. Ram Gamliel HaZokain, Hillel's grandson, pleaded with Rome for his removal, and eventually Rome did recall Pilate, and there was a brief period of quiet, a respite from the tormented century with the brief rule of Agrippus. Now, Agrippus was Herod's grandson. Herod had a son, Aristobulus, whom he himself murdered. When Aristobulus was murdered, the young Agrippus was sent by his mother to Rome to escape his grandfather's paranoid rages. So he was raised and educated in Rome. He was appointed the ruler in 37 by the Roman emperor, his friend and classmate, Gaius, childhood friends. So Agrippus was Roman, but he was Jewish as well, and he was accepted by the Chachamim. He had an unusually humble nature that he never hesitated to show. So Chazal mentioned, for example, he would bring his own bikurim on Shavuos and carry the basket on his shoulder, Vesamta Vatena, put the basket on his shoulder like a regular pilgrim. And that's how Agrippus would come. He would read the Torah at Hakel at the end of the Shemitah year, a famous story in Sota Daf Mem Aleph Amud Aleph Amud Beis. He was reading Mishnah Torah as the Melech, and he cried when he read in Shoftim that the king of Israel can only be Me'achicha, can only be amongst your brethren. And he was Jewish, but an Idumean convert. He started to cry that he wasn't eligible. And the Chachamim flattered him by saying, no, Achinu Ata, you are our brother, you are our brother. For that distortion of Torah, Chazal notes in the Gemara that that generation deserved, they earned destruction. Shechnifu lo lagrippus. You cannot flatter anyone and distort the Torah. So he died in 44, poisoned by the Greeks in Caesarea, who had objected to his pro-Jewish stance, but he's Zochu Latov, he's very favorably remembered. There are a few cities in Israel, including Yerushalayim, that have a Rehov Agrippus, named after him, and after his death, the land was returned to procurator rule, one worse than the next. Among the worst was the procurator Florus, who was appointed by Nero in 64, so bad that his rule sparked the revolt that led to the Churban. So he, Florus, provoked Jewish riots only to give his army, his troops, an opportunity to kill Jews by the thousands. And he would do this, just attack people on the street, and they would respond to the troops. He'd send massive forces to kill as many people as he could. By 66, the land was in open revolt. At the time, the only part of the Roman Empire that was not compliant. And when Jews revolt in Eretz Yisrael, as happened also other times in history, Jews were attacked across the empire as well, in Alexandria, in Damascus, and other places, Antioch, other places where Jews lived. Now, one thing doomed any chance of survival, and that was because civil war amongst Jews loomed. Now, my book is coming out in a few months on Sefer Shoftim. One of the points that I make is that the civil war, as bad as a reputation it has, is never welcome, but very often it clarifies the national purpose. I can't think, for example, of any nation that did not have a civil war in its history. America, Britain, France, Spain, Italy, Russia, Germany, etc. You go across the world, almost every nation has endured a civil war at one time or another. Of course, for a civil war, to clarify the national purpose, you need to have external peace. When you have a civil war, when enemies are trying to kill all of you, so that is suicidal. What happened was the zealots wanted war, the friends of Rome wanted accommodation, ultimately assimilation into Roman society. Most Jews belonged to neither group. In 66, the zealots began their revolt in the north. The Roman general Vespasian came down from Syria with four Roman legions to wage war. One of the officers sent to command Jewish forces in the Galil, a former Tzduki named Yosef Matasiah HaKohen surrendered. He became a Roman propagandist and a so-called historian. That was Josephus. In 67, the North fell with a mass suicide at Gamla on the Golan, at the fortress of Yodfat near Tzipori. Gush Chalav fell with its commander Yochanan of Gush Chalav fleeing to Yerushalayim. In due course, the entire nation had been conquered except for Yerushalayim. By 68, Yerushalayim was surrounded. Rather than rallying together, Jewish society disintegrated into what Chazal called Sinas Chinam. Sinas Chinam is translated as baseless hatred, but it's not baseless hatred. No hatred is baseless. I always say, ask me what I hate, I'll give you a reason for it. It's not baseless. Sinas Chinam is self-destructive hatred, meaning I don't care whether I live as long as you don't live. And it's exemplified in the Gemara by two stories, in Gittin, Daf Nun Hei and Nun Vav. The famous story of Bar Kamsa. So Bar Kamsa was invited to a reception. Instead of the host's friend, Kamsa, grievously insulted, especially the Chachamim there, acquiesced in the embarrassment. So Bar Kamsa informed on them to the Romans, even though he too would suffer their fate. That's Sinas Chinam. That's self-destructive. That means, I don't care whether I live as long as you don't live. So too, one of the zealot factions, the Biryonim, burnt the storehouses in Yerushalayim that contained supplies that could have withstood a siege of 21 years to provoke a war, even though they too would suffer. That's Sinas Chinam. They wanted to provoke Rome into a war, and war is what they got. But soon, and first, the Jews in Yerushalayim were fighting each other. Soon the Jews in Yerushalayim fought each other. The forces of Yochanan of Gush Chalav fought the armies of Shimon Bar Giora and others, and all hope was lost. The siege of Yerushalayim began in earnest in 69, and Titus, who was Vespasian's son, began his attack on Yerushalayim on Pesach of the year 70. They breached the outer walls, Herod's fortresses in the northern part of the city, Antonia Fortress and others, were very difficult to conquer, but they did. Hand-to-hand combat ensued for every inch of the city. By Shavasa B'Tammuz, the day of the famous fast, the walls of the Mikdash were breached. Heavy fighting occurred for 3 weeks from Shavasa B'Tammuz until Tisha B'Av. On the 9th of Av, the Romans captured the base of Mikdash. They set fire to it late in the afternoon, and it burned all through the 10th. The estimate is that during the war, right before and during the Churban, 1 million Jews were killed. Of a population maybe of 2.5 million Jews were killed. Titus returned to Rome in the year 71, the famous triumphal march through the Roman Forum, commemorating the arch with which we saw this past summer. Titus actually also built the Colosseum a few years later, right across the street, but that symbolized the defeat of Jews. There was one small group, led by Elazar ben Yair, who was a zealot, who had fled the fighting in the Galil in 67, and in 67 already, he took refuge in Mitzada, which was Herod's desert fortress. Titus' successor, Flavius Silva, laid siege to it in 72, but he was never able to conquer it. Eventually, as we know through Josephus' writings, the remnant committed suicide on the first day of Pesach in the year 73, an event that remarkably goes unrecorded in the Talmud, but certainly resonates in the modern Zionist movement. With Mitzada, Jewish resistance ended for almost a half century. It's actually not so remarkable that it's not recorded at all in the Talmud or the Midrashim, the suicide at Mitzada, because Chazal frowned on it, even disapproved. Had everyone followed their lead, we would have ceased to exist. There was another approach which was typified by the last great Jewish figure of this century, and that's Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Yochanan ben Zakkai became the Nasi Pro Tem, to mingle Hebrew and Latin, when Rabban Gamliel went into hiding to protect himself from the Romans and from the Jews. So the Gemara in Sukkah says that he was the youngest or the smallest, the lowest caliber of the Talmidim of Hill HaZaken. You can imagine what the Hill was and what his Talmidim were if Rabban Yochanan was the Ketanim Shebohem of 120 main disciples. So he was the youngest. Yochanan Zakkai made one of the most fateful decisions in Jewish history. Besides burning the storehouses of food and fuel, the zealots prohibited anyone from leaving the city. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had to have himself feigned death and was smuggled out of Yerushalayim in a coffin, helped by his nephew Abba Sikra, who was one of the heads of the zealots. So Rabbi Yochanan made it to the camp of Vespasian in the year 69, and he greeted Vespasian as emperor. It was most prescient as a messenger this just then arrived at that moment, informed Vespasian that the Roman Senate had appointed him Vespasian emperor. That year, 69, saw four people serve as emperors of Rome. Emperors of Rome in the year 69 had a shorter shelf life than tax cuts in an Obama administration. But that's a different point. In a fit of magnanimity, he, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, gave Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai three wishes. The fateful words that he uttered, Tein li Yavne v'chachameha, give me the city of Yavne v'chachamim, to reestablish Torah, to spare the family of the Nasi, so he saved at one moment Torah and Malchus, the family of Beis David, and medical care for Tzadok, who started fasting since the year 30, pleading for a respite from the looming Churban. Now, it was a fateful decision. Naturally, it was criticized. Rabbi Akiva very harshly criticized Rabbi Yochanan. If it was a shasa kosher, ask to have wishes granted, so ask that the station spare the Beis HaMikdash. And Rabbi Mitzakeh himself had doubts his whole life whether he made the right decision or not, but he felt that request would have been denied, and then he would have been left with nothing. In the end, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai saved Torah and saved the Jewish people. And the Sanhedrin relocated to Yavne before the Churban, so they were able to pick up the pieces after the Churban and restore Jewish life. And so our lives are still shaped by that today. For example, most people don't realize this. We take Lulav and Esrog for all 7 days of Sukkos today only Zecher LeMikdash, because of the takana of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. The Torah says, Ulkachtam Lachem Bayom Rishon. The Dalet Minim are mitzvah for the first day of Sukkos. Only in the Beis HaMikdash do they take the Lulav and Esrog for 7 days. Rabbi Yochanan said, no, Zecher LeMikdash will take it all 7 days. That's why we do it. The Yom HaNeif, the new season for Yashon, Tzvua, which had started growing a half year before, that starts the end of Tezayin Nisan. They blew the shofar in Yavne on Shabbos Rosh Hashanah, just like in the Beis HaMikdash. Other ordinances familiar to us were Zeche L'Churban, to leave a square amma unplastered in a new home, to leave a setting off a perfectly set table, restrictions on music. In other words, what Rabbi Yochanan did was try to find the right balance between mourning the loss of the Beis HaMikdash and living. And that we are here today is proof that he succeeded. So in that academy at Yavne, the halacha was decided in favor of Beis Hillel. The Shmon Esrei assumed its final form, as I mentioned, with Lamalshinim, and they changed the text of the bracha Uvnei Yerushalayim, because during the second Beis HaMikdash era, the bracha related to keeping Yerushalayim strong. Now it had to be Bin Yerushalayim, because Yerushalayim was destroyed. Freed of the deleterious influence of all the factions, the zealots were gone, the tzedukim were gone, the corrupt Kohanim Gadolim were gone, the corruption of the avod in the Beis HaMikdash had ceased, the Hellenists were gone. Freed of all this, the people returned to Torah, and Jewish life was slowly rebuilt. They also redeemed Jewish captives in Rome by the thousands. Ram Gamliel himself came out of hiding, resumed his role, even, and think about it, it's tremendously daring, even traveled to Rome to lobby the Romans to ease some of their restrictions against the Jews in the 70s. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai died in the year 80, around the year 80, at the age of 120 as well. Now something else happened. Shocking disclosure, Rabbanim do not always agree. Several times in Yavne there were bitter disputes involving Rabbi Gamliel, a very strong personality. In some of them he forced Rabbi Yeshua to accept his decision in order to reinforce the notion of the supremacy of the Nasi. But in one of these cases, Ram Gamliel himself was deposed as the Nasi by the Sanhedrin and replaced with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. They later shared the Nazias, all to reinforce the principle that no man is supreme. And the Sanhedrin ultimately is the representative of the klal, and it's not the tool of any particular person, and it's the representatives of the klal who should be dominant. It was on that day that Ram Gamliel was deposed. Bo Bayom, multitudes of Jews clustered in the Beis Medrash, hundreds of halachas were clarified, halacha kebeis Hillel was determined, the whole Meseches Edios was taught on that day, revisiting old machlokos and resolving them, and the principle of Acher Rab Lahatos, of majority rule, was confirmed, all because they had overthrown Rabbi Gamliel, and at the same time rabbinic authority was upheld but appropriately regulated, and again that endures until today, I think. Now the Emperor Domitian, who was Titus's brother and successor, became very troubled by the rebirth of Jewish life at Yavne, and so he ordered its disbandment in the year 86. And the Sanhedrin then moved to Lod, to Usha, and to other places. In one very interesting story, in the year in the 80s, there was an order given to exterminate all the Jews across the Roman Empire, and it was miraculously thwarted. You can see this in the Parsha Beis and Dvar Rabbah in Halacha Chof Dalid. The Jews were saved by a leading Roman official who was a Judeophile, who days before the decree was to be executed, 5 days before the decree was to be implemented, he killed himself. And that triggered a delay because of the 30 days of mourning for a Roman official. And by the time the 30 days of mourning were up, the Romans had moved on to something else. One of the numerous times that decrees were averted in mysterious ways. In the year 96, Nerva became the emperor, and he, strangely enough, befriended the Jews. He abolished many of the evil decrees of Domitian. He even removed conversion to Judaism as one of the capital crimes under Roman law. But at century's end, Nerva died, and the Emperor Trajan took power in 98, and he began another wave of persecution. So, in summary, the first century of the Common Era was one of the most influential and momentous of centuries in our history, with very long-lasting effects and reverberations until today. So, for example, Herod's reign, the few decades before, gave Israel many of the physical structures that teach our history and teach our connectedness to the land. Hillel began the process of codifying the oral law, and he enabled the people to embrace the Sanhedrin that was no longer a political force, but only a spiritual power. It was a new role, but one that would endure until modern times. We found that Jews would not sit still and acquiesce in foreign rule, but we found also, nor would we have the strength of character to submerge our differences in order to fight the more important battle against the foreign foe. And the civil war amongst the Jews was the primary cause of the destruction. We witnessed the birth of Christianity in the context of other messianic movements in an era of much turmoil and uncertainty, and by the end of the century, Christianity was moving away from its Jewish roots, but that process would take several centuries, at which point full-blown hatred would result. We saw the greatness and prescience of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, who saved Torah and reestablished the primacy of Torah in the absence of the Mikdash. The Mikdash had always been the national center, and people just relied on the Avodah, like, you know, bring a carbon for me, like, you say Kaddish for me, do it for me. In effect, what he did was supplant the life of the Mikdash and Yerushalayim with the daily obligations of Halacha. And we saw how the sages incorporated the memory of the Mikdash into our lives without allowing the Churban to strangle and to paralyze our lives. And in Yavne, the Chachamim, the Sanhedrin, laid down rules for the interpretation of halacha, for dealing with machlokos, and the resolution of disputes, all of those would be refined in subsequent centuries and would endure for 2,000 years until today. In a real sense, we are the beneficiaries of their wisdom and their dedication, but we could say the same, and we will, about every other century. I thank you very much. Next week, we'll look at the second century.